Major League Baseball is very big business. Mike Trout of the Los Angeles Angels makes more than $33 million a year. He plays pretty much every day. But a pitcher, Steven Strasburg, actually makes more than that, playing once or twice a week. We'll forget the big names and the big salaries for a while. In this hour, we'll focus on small ball, or more accurately, small-time ball. Back at the zenith of the minor leagues, professional teams dotted the landscape with ballparks in just about any town of decent size. Galen White takes us back to those days in a book called Left on Base in the Bush Leagues, Legends, Near Greats, and Unknowns in the Minors. Galen White worked as a sports writer for three major newspapers before he diverted to the corporate world for several decades. He returned to sports writing, has been cranking out books for 5 years, including Singles and Smiles, which brought him to the Exchange in June of last year. So, Galen White, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Great to be back, Jeff.
For people wondering how you can crank out books so fast, this actually was a long time coming from the sounds of it.
The research for Left on Base and Singles and Smiles started in the 1970s. I had just read Roger Kahn's classic, Boys of Summer, and I was inspired by how he went and wrote about these Dodger players from the 50s, wrote about them as human beings, not just ball players. And that inspired me to do that with some of the minor league players that I had seen growing up in Los Angeles.
I guess I didn't realize how big the minor league system once was. Give us some sketches and compare it to today.
The high point was 1949. There were 59 leagues and 463 towns with teams. By comparison, there's 256 minor leagues today. You only had in the majors, however, 16 teams. 11 of those 16 were in five cities. So when you use the term national pastime, where baseball was truly national, was at the minor league level. At the major league level, it was quite regional.
So let me get that number again. So you said 256 teams today?
256 minor league teams today.
Mm-hmm.
Compared with 463 then.
Wow.
And the number of leagues, I'm not sure of the leagues right now, but then the high point was 59. The cover of the book shows, it was a Life magazine cover photo from 1948. The photograph was taken at Dodgertown, and there are 515 rookies looking up at the camera. It's an amazing shot. What it shows is two things. One, they're all white. That's the year after Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in 1947 in the majors. So most of the minors were still white. And, of course, the number, 515 rookies just in the Dodgers organization alone.
That's a pretty amazing number. So so things have changed. A lot fewer people coming, getting interested in baseball and want to play the game in the United States now?
Well, I think you have the other sports. At that time in the 50s, when all these players came out of World War II. So what you had during World War II was the major leagues barely kept going. The minor leagues shrunk. Then after the war, there was this flood of players that came onto the scene. You had all these towns that, because of various rationing and so forth, people had money. And, of course, there was the prosperity after World War II. So every town wanted a team. By and large, the thing was, if you had a bank in town, you were going to have a minor league team in town. So that's the way it worked, and so you had all these teams. Most of them were independent. They had no affiliation with the majors. By comparison today, almost all your minor league teams are connected with the major league teams.
Now, people are used to probably some of the classifications. We get used to hearing about the people who just got called up from AAA, and then, of course, there's AA, there's single-A long season, single-A short season. But back then, there was B, C, and D, so there's nothing below Class A now. Is that right?
No. What they did around 1960 when they expanded the major leagues, they kind of flattened out the minors. Actually, what they wanted to do was to kind of get rid of what they thought were some of these lower letters that were demeaning. And actually, the term major and minors baseball is the only one that uses that. And there was talk for some time, even in the 50s, about how do you get around calling part of your product minor. The categories of D, C, B, and then there was Class A, AA, and AAA. And then in the Coast League, near the end of its time, it was an open classification. That was judged on the size of the city, not so much the caliber of the baseball. So you might have a team in Class D, a smaller team, that would have a team that might be as good as one on Class B.
And guys apparently went from D-ball straight to the majors upon occasion.
Yes, it was rare, but it happened. And one occasion was a pitcher by the name of Ron Necktie. Dizzy Dean called him Necktie. And in 1952, Ron Necktie, 19 years old, struck out 27 in a nine-inning game. That's the only time that's been done in baseball history. It's considered the number one record, one that will never be broken. He struck out in 45 and two-third innings at Bristol, Virginia, a Class D league. He struck out 109 batters. He went from there to Class B, Burlington, North Carolina, and before the 52 season was up, he was pitching for the Pittsburgh Pirates. He had a 1-6 record. Branch Rickey, long after he left baseball, was asked to put together his all-star team of players who played for him either in St. Louis, Brooklyn, or in Pittsburgh. And Ron Necktie, he named as the greatest all-round pitcher that he ever saw, and he had the best fastball, and he had all the learning aptitudes. He was great. So that was a Branch Rickey quote. Necktie hurt his arm at the end of the 52 season. He actually went into the Army. He already had ulcers. The food in the Army made it worse. He was discharged after 3 months. He started throwing a little too soon after the discharge, hurt his arm, and never appeared in the majors again. But he did make that jump from Class D all the way to the majors.
So was that his lifetime record, 1 win and 6 losses in the majors?
1 win and 6 losses, and, of course, the one that he says could win any trivia contest in any bar is striking out 27 in one game. Nobody believes that one, but it's been the answer to several trivia questions.
Now, interesting thing about, we talked about Rocket Ron Necktie and his 27 strikeouts in a nine-inning game, which nobody else has done. He didn't last very long in the majors. But you point out early in the book, some guys chose to stay in the minor leagues. Why?
The classic example of that is Joe Bauman, who set the all-time home run record of 72 in a single season. That was in 1954. And that was a professional baseball record until Barry Bonds hit 73 in 2001 at the major league level. But, of course, I like to refer to Joe Bauman's home runs as steroid-free. Joe did get his high. He had one at-bat in Double A, and then he went to Class A, spent an entire season in Hartford, Connecticut. The Boston Braves, who owned his contract, wanted to cut his salary $200 a month. He told them he could make more money selling shoestrings on the streets in Oklahoma City. He left organized baseball and went to Elk City, Oklahoma, to play semi-pro ball. That's where he played for 3 years when Artesian, New Mexico, persuaded him to come back to organized baseball. And in 1954, after leaving Artesia, he hit the 72 home runs. His main incentive for going to Roswell, where he hit the home runs, was he wanted to run a Texaco service station. He had owned one on Route 66 in Elk City for 3 years. It was very successful. And Joe's attitude was he can make as much or more money pumping gas than he could pumping home runs over the fence, although he did pretty well at that too. He just preferred to stay in the minors. He didn't like big cities. And that was the same of another ball player from Roswell, New Mexico, Tom Jordan Sr. He'll turn 100 years old next month. He's the oldest living major league ball player. Tom was with three different teams in the majors in the 40s. In each case, he went back to Roswell to his ranch, where he had a very prosperous one, farming cotton, and he would then play with minor league teams nearby. He had a very successful minor league career, but his choice was to stay in the minors rather than go to the majors.
You know, it's funny you mentioned Joe Bauman. We'll want to get further details on him later on, but it seems like you could have researched a good bit of the book by hanging out at Texaco stations.
Yes. He was was a man who wore the Texaco Star. That's the title of the chapter on Joe, and he liked the small-town life. Every time he hit a home run in Roswell, there was a meat packing company in town that gave Joe a free ham, and he often referred to the Roswell team as the best-fed team in America because he'd hit so many home runs, he'd give hams to his teammates, to the umpires, and sometimes to the opposing players. So he was a very popular guy. The attitude of the many minor leaguers, particularly the Stars, was they could do better in the minors. Not only did they make as much money, particularly when they hit home runs and they got money through the screen, there was a tradition called picking the fences. So after Joe Bauman, for example, would hit a home run, the fans would stick $1, $5, or $10 bills through the screen. When he broke the record in 1954, he hit three home runs and a doubleheader. That day, he collected $800, or the equivalent of $8,000 today, through the screen.
It's pretty funny. There's a picture in the book of this going on, and it's just kind of weird. It's not something that happens in baseball now, but the idea of people hanging all these dollar bills like they're going in and handing them off to a stripper or something.
Yes, well, that was a... Yes, they called it lettuce or cabbage, so it's picking the lettuce or picking the cabbage. It was a tradition that started in West Texas, in Amarillo, where Joe, after he came out of the Navy, his first team he played for was in Amarillo. He led all the minor leagues in home runs that year. A couple years later, now Joe was back east playing at Hartford, a teammate of his called Bob Roundtrip Cruz. I think Roundtrip is one of the all-time classic nicknames.
Right.
He got that nickname because he hit 69 home runs in 1948 that tied the then single-season record for home runs in a season. But what he also did was drive in 254 runs. The record in the major leagues to this day is 195. The closest anybody in modern times has come would be in the 160 range, and that was Manny Ramirez a few years ago. So Bob Roundtrip Cruz was one of these. He was called the Babe Ruth of West Texas. He also collected a lot of money through the screen. So these players who were good minor league players could supplement their monthly income with the screen money. And then, of course, most of them had side jobs. And it's like one ball player said, he said, why do I want to go to the majors and be just a spear carrier? Because in the majors, most of the players there made what was the minor league minimum. That was $5,000 or $6,000 a year. You didn't have the big money then, obviously. And so without the big money, a lot of these guys chose to stay in the minors where they were heroes and they could do just as well financially.
Galen White is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Left on Base in the Bush Leagues. Joe Bauman, the guy who hit the 72 home runs, the X-Files did an episode with a Joe-like character, is that right?
Yes. The character in the X-Files was Josh Exley. So it was a cross between Joe Bauman and Josh Gibson. And so there was this alien who came back, and he broke a single-season record, and there's a dialogue in the show about these two kids arguing about how significant the record was, and one of them was saying, well, it's just a minor league record. Well, it's interesting because a lot of people have said that about Joe Bauman's record. It's just a minor league record. I don't care what league you play in. If you hit 72 home runs in 138 games now, that's quite amazing, And he also hit well over 400 that year and drove in 220 runs. Joe Bauman, most of the attention that he has received was not while he was playing. The photograph you referred to was in Life magazine after he broke the record in 1954. But by and large, he was in obscurity until Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa were chasing the all-time record in 1998 and then, of course, in 2001. When Barry Bonds hit 73. Up until that time, Joe was basically an obscure player living out the rest of his life in Roswell, New Mexico. There is the home run champion in the minors today does receive the Joe Bauman Award. So, again, he has gotten far more attention late in his life or after he died in 2005 than he got while he was living.
There's another, just the level of detail in the book is exquisite. Bob Cruz, we just mentioned, Roundtrip Cruz, there was some doubt about the number of home runs he hit in 1948. What was that about?
Well, he actually got robbed of one by an umpire who ruled that the ball had not gone out of the park, when in fact there's a number of witnesses who said it did. If Cruz had hit 70 home runs that year, breaking the record, Wheaties had already contacted him and his wife, and they were going to put Bob Cruz on the front of the Wheaties boxes if he hit 70 home runs. He never made it there. He never got his image on a Wheaties box.
Did the Wheaties company pay the umpire or something?
Well, that umpire situation occurred earlier in the year. So when he got down towards the end and he went into the last day of the season, there was a doubleheader, and he had 69 home runs. He just needed one. Usually the wind in Amarillo was blowing out. On that particular day, it was blowing in. So he went. He had four hits, but none of them were homers, and as a result, he was denied the cover of Wheaties.
Wow. The book, again, is called Left on Base in the Bush Leagues, Legends Near Greats and Unknowns in the Minors. It's a rich tapestry that Galen White weaves of some of the really interesting characters in minor league baseball at its zenith in the late 40s, early 50s, before the big decline began. About half as many minor league teams today as there were then. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And here's an email from Stephen Eugene, who says, a question for you. Where did the term Bush leagues come from, Galen?
Ring Lardner made the term famous. He was a writer in the early 1900s. He did a book in 1916 called You Know Me, Al. It's a classic. It consists of letters from a fictional Bush League pitcher named Jack Keefe, and he's writing to a friend, Al Blanchard, back home in Indiana. So all six chapters in You Know Me, Al have the word Bush in its titles. The term worked its way into the baseball lexicon. Bushes was a common term for anything outside of the majors. I certainly didn't consider or don't consider Los Angeles, Portland, San Francisco, any of the cities where some of these players played to be Bush League. But there was an Eastern mentality at that time that anything that was kind of west of the Hudson was sort of the Bushes to the writers there in New York. And so it was widely used even for towns like San Francisco.
So there was a guy named Bill Piero who thought the term Bush Leagues was unfair, and this is a guy who probably knows from unfair. Tell us a bit about Bill.
Well, Bill, I always remember I was talking with Gus Bell, who was a pretty good ball player in his time in the majors, and he asked me if you ever heard of Bill Piero, and I had not. But Bill Piero was a pitcher in the minors. He started in Class D. He, too, made it up to the majors. He threw extremely hard. His nickname was Wild Bill Piero. He made it to the majors. Unfortunately, what happened to him was he became sick. They weren't quite sure what the illness was. Turned out to be encephalitis. And there's a reaction to that disease where you almost look like you're drunk. And so Bill wound up having to leave baseball. But I remember interviewing Bill, and, of course, he was aware of the term Bush League, and he was aware of what I was going to call the book. And he registered his concern about it, which was anybody who makes it to the majors should not even have the term Bush League or Bush Leaguer associated with them. And he's right. He's right on that. But also, you know, what I'm writing about was a period of time where that term was quite widely used for players who didn't make it up there. And you can argue whether it's fair or unfair. I happen to agree with Bill it was unfair. But this is what really has fascinated me about sports, particularly baseball, is that we draw this line between success and failure. You can be successful at the lower level, let's say the Bush League or minor league level, and you get to the big leagues and you don't have the same success, you're considered a flop. And so in writing about these players, I wanted to tell their stories in a way where you'll see it's not quite that simple. And it's not that simple in sports, nor is it in life. You know, we all have this line between success and failure. And we sometimes think we're a failure when really we're not. We have been quite successful up to that point. It just so happens that at a certain level, you have more difficulty. So that's one of the things I wanted to bring out in this book, was the complexity of all of success and failure, and the complexity that these guys faced at this time trying to succeed at the highest level.
And in fact, you mentioned a character named Frosty Kennedy in the book who talked about how hard it is to hit 60 homers in the Bush Leagues.
Oh, yes. Well, there's two things that make it real hard. The lights in a lot of these ballparks weren't very good. Number two, he was facing pitchers, young kids, who didn't know where the ball was going. And one of them I write about in the book, Steve Dalkowski. He is known widely as the throwing harder than anybody in history, including Nolan Ryan. Steve Dalkowski's nickname was Whiff or Walk Dalkowski, because one season at Stockton, he struck out 262 in a single season, and he also walked 262. Dalkowski was the inspiration for the character Nuke LaRouche in the movie Bull Durham.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, Ebby Calvin, Nuke LaRouche, right.
Right.
So another character I want to bring. First of all, let me just ask a general question, which is with all the colorful people that you had to deal with, this book easily could have gone to at least a shelf of books, I think.
Yes, there was a fairly long list that I had to prune. I got input from Harry Dunlop, who was a longtime coach in the majors, as well as Jack McKeon, who has managed several teams in the majors. When I started the research in the 1970s, I lived in Kansas City. I often was doing freelancing out the ballpark, Royal Stadium. McKeon was the manager of the Royals, so I would go out early to batting practice. And I shared with them what I was doing, and they were interested in it, had some names to give me. In fact, one of the names Jack McKeon gave me was Joe Taylor. Joe Taylor played in Portland. His first three at-bats for the Portland Beavers, Matty which Fung. Was a Coast League team, he hit three home runs. Eddie Basinski, who was a teammate, said, "I thought I was looking at a black Babe Ruth."
That good?
He was that good. And he was also not only a heavy hitter, he was a heavy drinker. And that's really what kept him his career from kept him out of Cooperstown, you might say, because several of the guys I interviewed said that Joe Taylor was a guy who had power plus, and he should have been in Cooperstown. In fact, Branch Rickey saw Joe Taylor play. This was in the early 1950s, and he wrote in a report, he said, "He plays a great game when sober. He has a reputation for being a complete rounder, a fence-screeching tomcat with not enough females in sight. 'Tis said he even plays a good game with a snoot full. This fellow can run, and he can throw, and he can hit the ball a fur piece." That was Branch Rickey on Joe Taylor.
Wow. There's another guy I want to bring in here, Smead Jolly, who had some talents of his own, but had a bit of a deficiency in his game, it sounds like.
He was the epitome of the great hitter and bad fielder. There's a story about Smead Jolly. It's a classic. He made it up to the majors. He was playing at Boston's Fenway Park, and Smead had trouble with what they called Duffy's Cliff. This was an incline in left field. It was put there to help fielders know when they're getting close to the wall. And so it went up, and Smead had trouble going up that hill. So his manager, Donnie Bush, with the White Sox, worked with him for several hours going up the hill. And it got to the point where Smead was doing it pretty well. Well, in the game, the ball was hit up on the hill. Smead looked like he was going to catch it, and then he realized he had to come down the hill. The ball wasn't going to go that far. When he came down the hill, he fell down. Later on, he complained that, "Hey, they showed me how to go up the hill, but nobody told me how to come down."
It seems like Smead Jolly would have been the kind of guy who would have been fine at being a designated hitter in the American League today.
Oh, he would have, and same thing goes for Joe Brovia, who was called also a Smead Jolly-type player. In fact, Joe Brovia played in Portland for 3 years. He was a great hitter, one of the all-time great hitters in the Coast League. His first game as a pro, as an 18-year-old, Joe Brovia made three errors and had three hits off the best pitcher in the league. Joe did not make it to the majors until 1955. He was 33 years old. It took him 15 years to get there with the Cincinnati Reds. And when he did, he lasted 39 days. They only used him as a pinch hitter. If he'd come along today, he would have been an everyday DH and would have been a great one.
So I want to ask you mentioned Portland, and I just want to get into the Pacific Coast League and the level of quality there, because, you know, at a time when the major leagues stopped west at St. Louis, this was a pretty good league, wasn't it?
Well, it was some considered a third major league. That might be stretched too far, but it was an open classification in this latter years. The Dodgers and the Giants came out in 58, which changed the Coast League as it was, at least up to that time. It was in many ways more major league than the majors, and I say that because they traveled by air when they weren't traveling by air back in the big leagues. Many of the players, Brovia, Artie Wilson, who I wrote a book about, Singles and Smiles, they made more money in the Coast League than they did in the majors. The players, particularly the older players, liked the Coast League better because of the weather in the cities that they played in was milder. They could extend their careers. They often had their schedules were such that, let's say, the Portland Beavers would go on to L.A. Well, L.A. had two teams, the Hollywood Stars and Los Angeles Angels.
I want to finish the thought about the PCL, the Pacific Coast League, because it was really good in its day before the Dodgers and Giants colonized the West Coast in 1958.
Yes, and as I was saying, when teams would go into Los Angeles, where there was the Hollywood Stars, Los Angeles Angels, so let's say the Portland Beavers went in there, the players would be there for 2 weeks, two full weeks. So while you were on the road, that's not bad duty to be in L.A. for 2 weeks. Or if you were in the Bay Area, they had two teams, Oakland and San Francisco. So there again, you would spend 2 weeks in the area. So players really liked the Coast League. Many of them had a chance to go back to the majors and did not want to go back. That was the case of Steve Bilkel, who, of course, eventually did. But he was quite content and actually waived his right to be drafted by a major league team. There were other players like Carlos Bernier, who I write about in the book. He spent 13 years in the Coast League, starting at Hollywood. And then after expansion, after the Dodgers went west, the Hollywood team had to go to Salt Lake City, and then he wound up in Hawaii. Well, Carlos was a legend in the Coast League. He spent 1 year in the majors with Pittsburgh in 1953 and didn't like it and chose to stay in the minors the rest of his life. And Bob Dillinger, who had great success in the majors, batting 306 over six seasons there, he got sent to the minors. Basically, he was exiled there, but once he got there, he just decided to stay because, again, he preferred playing in the Coast League and making as much money as he, almost as much money as he did in the majors.
So, Galen, give us a sense of how players ended up on teams. It sounds like the draft system of today was a bit different back then.
Well, if you were on a team, they didn't have free agency. So if you got in a bad situation, you were kind of stuck, and that's why Joe Bauman left baseball and went and played semi-pro ball. That you were, in effect, a slave.
The reserve clause, yeah, which Flood finally challenged, yeah.
Right, and Curt Flood, of course, got it changed. I might mention that Joe Taylor and Curt Flood were roommates when they played for the St. Louis Cardinals, but these players were essentially, if they got on the bad side of a team, of an ownership, they were screwed. And Bob Dillinger was a classic case of that. Here again, a 306 hitter in the majors, three-time stolen base champion in the American League, and nobody in the majors would touch him, even for the price of $10,000. And that's how he wound up in the Coast League. The reason was, as he explained it, I didn't give management the respect they thought they deserved. So if you got on the bad side, you were likely to be in the minors, stuck in some town.
We have an email here from Lawrence in Ashland who says, not to be a stickler, but you said Manny Ramirez was second all-time in RBIs at 160 to the fellow at 200-plus in the minors. No Hack Wilson while playing. Actually, he played in the National League, had 191 season, I thought. You didn't say that Hack Wilson didn't have that. You just said that the most recent high RBIs.
So let me make it clear. Hack Wilson owns the minor league record. I believe it's 195. So that's minor league record. That's
major league record.
Yeah. And Manny Ramirez, I said in modern times, Manny Ramirez cranked out, drove in around 160, maybe 165. I've got it here somewhere. But that would be the most, the highest in most in recent times. But Hack Wilson has the major league record. Bob Cruz, the all-time record, 254.
That is just an amazing number. And 138 games or something like that?
138 games, right.
Wow. Yeah. There's a second part to the question from Lawrence and Ashland. He wants to know if your book covers some of the great off-the-field entertainers like the Clown Prince of Baseball, Max. Was it Patkin or Plotkin?
Patkin.
Okay.
He may be mentioned in one of the chapters because Max Patkin appeared throughout the minor leagues as part of their promotion of getting fans out to the ballpark. And one of the great showmen in the minor leagues was a fellow named Joe Engel. He was known as the P.T. Barnum of the Bushes, and he operated the team out of Chattanooga, the Chattanooga Lookouts. In 1949, Joe Engel brought in one of the all-time colorful characters, Bobo Newsom. Newsom had already won 211 games in the majors, 205 games in the majors, and he was trying to work his way back up to the majors, so he spent 2 years in Chattanooga and a third year in Birmingham. But together, Bobo Newsom and Joe Engel, I call it the Bobo and JoJo show because they were both great entertainers. Max Patkin made appearances at a number of lookout games because that was right down Joe Engel's alley.
Did Joe Engel sounds like Bill Veeck in a minor league sense.
Absolutely. Even more so. He once gave away a house at the ball game. He often would have, on opening day, the local officials on elephants, Campbells, and others coming into the ballpark. There was no prank was too great for Joe Engel. In fact, when he signed Bobo Newsom, many people thought it was another one of Joe's pranks.
Really? Okay, that's fun. So let's go to the really small places, the biggest little baseball city in the United States, La Mesa, Texas. How did it get that name?
Well, one year, I think it was 1951, this town of 8,000, La Mesa, Texas, attracted over 100,000 fans. They had a ball player named D.C. Pud Miller play there one year. He had 52 home runs despite missing the first 6 weeks of the season. So they had some good ball players come through there. It was a Class C team. They outdrew teams from Amarillo and Albuquerque, which were much larger towns. Fans, even when La Mesa was on the road and were playing a game, for example, in Albuquerque, fans would come out to the ballpark where the PA announcer would be reading what was happening in Albuquerque, and the fans would either sit in their cars or in the stands listening to the game. That's how diehard a baseball town it was.
Let me underscore that. So people were sitting in a stadium where the game was not going on, listening to play-by-play being recreated.
Yes, that's true. They during the playoffs with Albuquerque one year, the regular play-by-play announcer was on the PA system, reading from the teletype what was happening, and the fans were sitting either in their cars or in the stands.
That's unbelievable. And you just think, so it's a town of 8,000 people and got 100,000 out to the ballpark that year.
Yes, and it was known as the biggest little city in baseball for a while. In fact, in those years, there were the title of biggest little town in baseball was one that a lot of cities claimed. In fact, my next book is going to be about a town in Crowley, Louisiana, that for three straight years, this town of 12,000 people attracted over 100,000 fans, and so therefore they were called the best little town in the baseball world. That was Crowley, Louisiana. But that wasn't uncommon for small towns. They were very competitive, and they wanted to outdo the other, and if they could claim that title, they did.
So there's some great details about teams and games in the West Texas New Mexico League, which La Mesa was part of. But once that zenith passed in 1949, I mean, how steep did the slide in attendance get?
Pretty quick. La Mesa, for example, had where we were talking about the fans going out and sitting in the stands or listening from their cars. About 4 or 5 years later, they were without a team. Entirely. One did come back a little later, but again, they had a drought in the region, which affected that. But at the same time, the minor leagues were shrinking drastically. Part of the reason was the Korean War, which shrunk the talent pool. One of the teams in that part of the country, Big Spring, Texas, and I write about this, they turned to Cuban players. The manager there, Pat Stacy, an outstanding player, had never made it to the majors, but after the war, came back to Texas, started this team in Big Spring, and he was the only non-Cuban on the team. They became known as the Yankees of the lower minors. They were so dominating. They won two pennants, finished second three times, third another time. One of the players they produced was pitcher Camilo Pascual, who became an outstanding pitcher in the majors. His brother, however, Carlos Potato Pascual, and he was called Potato because he looked like one, he was another one of these players that jumped all the way from Class D to the majors. He was a very fine player, but he preferred to play with Pat Stacy wherever he was managing, whether it was Big Spring or later in Hobbs, New Mexico. Again, Stacy surrounded himself with Cuban players wherever he went.
What kind of abuse did the players take, though, when they were new to Texas?
Well, interesting enough, several of them stayed. This interesting story about Big Spring was Pat Stacy brought over close to 200 Cuban players. Many of them stayed. One of them, a fellow who I write about, Tito Arancibia, he stayed and later brought over 39 members of his family from Cuba, sparing him from Castro. So a lot of these players brought over their families, and therefore their families were able to avoid what happened under Castro. So quite a human interest story for them. coming to this country was that opportunity, not only to make more money, but also for freedom. And so I think the Big Spring story is the kind of story that I really like to tell, and that's that kind of human interest story. It's more than baseball. These guys came here to play baseball, but they found they could lead a better life, and many of them did.
Attitudes changed over time. I mean, the integration of baseball, and even in Texas and other southern states, it got better over time, didn't it?
Yes. In fact, the Cubans, even though they were light-skinned Cubans, they helped integrate baseball in Texas because initially, of course, there was resistance to them, even though they were light-skinned. But over time, because they were such talented players, they won the fan over. So pretty soon you had dark-skinned Cubans coming over, then African-Americans. In fact, La Mesa, this little town in Texas of 8,000 people, was the first to use a black player in Texas.
Wow, that was a feat for a town that size.
It was quite a stretch. And, of course, the manager, Jay Haney, took a lot of criticism for doing it, but his rationale was he had been in the military. He had played ball with the black players in the military. And his reasoning was, hey, if they're good enough to play with us in the military, they're good enough to play with us in pro ball. So he brought them in. Now, Jay Haney didn't last too much longer in La Mesa. He went on to manage elsewhere in Texas, but he broke the color barrier with a ball player there in La Mesa, Texas.
Vaughn in Medford got on the phone but didn't stay. He wanted to talk about Medford's minor league baseball history, which, as I see looking at an As It Was piece on our website, started in 1948 with the Medford Nuggets. We had the Nuggets, the Medford Giants, the Medford Dodgers, the Medford A's, which eventually became the Southern Oregon Timberjacks, and then the major league affiliated teams stopped. There is still a Medford Rogues team, which just ended its season recently. So thanks for the update on that, Vaughn. I had to ask about when we're talking about the number of minor league teams, it seems like with the fact that there are so many more major league teams, they'd need a bigger farm system.
Well, you would think that, but of course, the cost has caused them to keep it at the levels they have now. The players in the minors now, many of them have signed bonus contracts and are making more than the guys made back then. I had one player tell me in those days, you almost had to pay them to play. That's how much most of the players wanted to play. It was very competitive. And just to be able to play on these teams was a lifetime experience for these guys. And many of them went on, of course, to have successful careers in other fields. But it was an honor for these guys to play minor league baseball. And they loved the game. And, of course, playing during that time gave them that honor. Today, personally, I prefer watching minor league players today. The ballparks are much nicer than they were back then. I was recently in Roswell where the ballpark is now called Joe Bauman Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
The team is called the Roswell Invaders. They wear alien green uniforms. It was fun.
So outside of places like Roswell, the little towns like La Mesa, I'm sure, lost their teams. Did they go all in on high school football or start watching TV, or what did they do for diversions?
Well, that I don't know for sure. Many of them, of course, will follow Major League Baseball now, but not to the degree they did. You know, baseball in towns like Alpine, Texas, which is kind of the gateway to Big Bend National Park, far from anything else in Texas. They play in the Pecos League. It's a semi-pro league. They just won that this year. The ballpark they play in, Coconut Field, which is still considered one of the great ballparks, it was built in 1948. So, you know, there's still some great ballparks and teams in the minors that are keeping the tradition alive.
That is good to know that the tradition goes on. The book is called Left on Base in the Bush Leagues, Legends, Near Greats, and Unknowns in the Minors, a collection that's 45 years in the making from Galen White. Galen, a pleasure to talk to you once again. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Take care. That'll do it.